Episode 21, There's Gold and Then There Hits, in which Kenneth Moore finds the popular music world of the early 50s energetically going in no particular direction. He sees the record industry learning to think in millions, and British artists and record producers facing the Americans with the classic formula, come on out, we've got you covered.
Anyone trying to deal adequately with the popular music of the early 1950s quickly begins to feel like the curator of a museum with more exhibits than there are cases to put them in. That in retrospect the stuff appears to include a large proportion of trinkets and junk jewellery doesn't make his job any easier. He has to tell it, as a more recent expression has it, like it was. So, although at the close of last week's episode we noted the publication of the first British record sales charts and hinted at the rather bewildering international scene they reflected, we had no room to convey fully the teeming activity of an enterprise which suddenly found itself to be very big business indeed. Nor did we have a chance to consider what effect the charts themselves might have had on the music. So, for part of the time this week, we shall be listening in more detail to the sounds of the great gold rush.
If your sweetheart sends a letter of goodbye, it's no secret you feel better if you cry when waking from a bad dream. Don't you sometimes think it's real, but it's only false emotions that you feel. If your heartaches seem to sunshine can be found behind a cloudy sky, so let your head down and go on and cry.
Johnny Ray, who startled the world by crying real tears. It was probably that, more than his hearing aid and gaunt, undernourished look, that produced screaming in theatres, the like of which had not been heard since Frank Sinatra had turned on ladies of all ages back in the early 40s. That was a big thing about Johnny Ray. He delivered on stage the sounds that had got him to the top on records. Sometimes this week we shall appear to be crossing and recrossing our path, even hearing about an effect before we've understood its cause. But the appearance in Britain of a record chart in 1952 was only a symptom, a visible rash indicating the turmoil that had been going on under the skin for some time. So it's not as perverse as it appears to go one step further and find out how much it meant to the public to be presented with these league tables of what amounted to a new sport. Andy Gray, managing editor of the New Musical Express, which published those first charts, explains their fascination.
people would read them and be very interested, and they would be sort of one up if you'd bought that record before they did get in the chart. But if you didn't, you wanted to know why everybody liked it, and you bought it. But not only that, in the music business itself, they always used to watch the chart very carefully, and if a certain type of record was popular, they would get out with the same kind. It was called getting on the bandwagon. Also, the charts were rather important because they were taken up by the national papers, they were taken up by the BBC, and therefore the music business for the first time had a barometer and a spokesman, as it were, for the outer world. And I think in that case that the charts have done a great job. It's a great responsibility doing charts, of course, because you get the odd person who says, oh, they're not accurate, one thing or another. We've always had that. But I can assure you that the people who contribute to the charts, that's the retailers, want it to be as accurate as possible because they order their records on it. And if it's a dud chart, it's no good to them at all.
So, presumably, having run his eye over that first chart, the record retailer in Greenwich or Fazakerley or whatever, who probably sold bicycles and batteries as well, would check his stocks of Al Martino's Here in My Heart, standing at number one, and maybe have the number two playing in the shop, this record by Joe Stafford.
Darling, all the while you belong to me. See the marketplace in old Algiers. Send me photographs and souvenirs. Just remember when a dream appears.
You Belong to Me, Joe Stafford at number two in the first ever British record sales chart. We are now well into the period when the record industry was beginning to expect sales of a million or more. It didn't quite know what the formula was, and in Joe Stafford's case, it was willing to resort to superstition.
Everybody always used to say to me, get pregnant again, because I was pregnant in 1952 and had 4 million sellers in a row. And Mitch Miller one day said, you got to get pregnant again. Because it was having the right songs at the right time, at the right place. And it was phenomenal. It was really wild.
Joe Stafford and what you might call her fertile period. But all this talk of million sellers is just cold, abstract statistics, unless you can relate it to what it meant to the artist. You can get some idea of the financial rewards and of the diversity of the scene from this snatch of talk by film producer Joe Pasternak. You'll have to strain your ears a bit, for Mr. Pasternak has only been in America 40 years, and his European accent is quite strong. But the singer he's talking about is Mario Lanza.
He came to me one day and he showed me a check for $1,100,000 for royalties on his recordings. And, you know, if a man didn't have $10, and you get a check like that, very few of them could stay sober. You see, he was so strong that even today, I think he gets, what, $75,000 a year in royalties. Even today, he's been dead for many years.
Be my love, for no one else can end this yearning, this need that you and you alone create. Just fill my arms the way you filled my dreams, the dreams that you inspire.
In the same year that sub-operatic Lanza was selling by the million, the record-buying world was also set twanging by the music of a mild little Austrian zither player. From your seat up in the gods of the theatres, which he toured on the strength of it, you could have mistaken him for Arthur Askey. That is, until he played. Anton Karas with the Harry Lime theme, first heard in the film The Third Man. Record sales figures often read as if they've come to publicity men in a dream, but the claim that a total of 40 million copies of various performers' versions of the Harry Lime theme had been sold a decade or so later does at least reveal two things. One is that by any standard it was pretty popular. The other is that an apparently definitive version by the original artist didn't stop other people recording it. And so we come to one of the guiding principles of popular music in the early 1950s. Almost any song or tune was regarded as anybody's property. It's only by the 70s that the idea of Brian Ferry faltering through these foolish things has become a novelty. In the 50s, personal sound was beginning to be important, it's true, but the number was the thing.
They try to tell us we're too young. Too young to really be in love. They say that love's a word we've only heard, but can't begin to know the meaning of. And yet, we're not too young to know. This love will last, though years may go. And then someday they may recall we were not young at all.
It's natural to assume that If, say, you were a record producer and you fancied making your own version of Nat King Cole's Too Young, all you had to do was to move quickly and get your record out before anyone else thought of it. But it wasn't quite as straightforward as that. This is Alan Freeman. There are, of course, two Alan Freemans connected with gramophone records, the one who plays them on the air and the one who used to make them.
In those days, the publishers used to put a release date on it. There was a broadcasting restriction and a mechanical release date, so that you could not come out before a date, you could not go on the air before a date. So the rat race started that day. It was a matter of if you could get your record on that particular day first. So everybody was going for programs like Housewife's Choice, which was very strong, and there was a morning show. That was the big plug to get in first on of the day.
Well, of course, given conditions like that, it's obvious that plugging became really fierce. It so happened that Too Young was a number that Alan Freeman wanted to cover with a new singer named Jimmy Young.
I found Jimmy, an old friend Alan Holmes brought him to me, and we recorded Jimmy initially with Ray Martin, then Ray signed up with another label, with EMI, and we used Ron Goodwin, and this was Ron's first record with Jimmy Young. It was Too Young. I had the record ready 4 weeks before release date. There again was a set release date, and it was a Saturday. And Jack Jackson was the king of kings in those days. And if Jack picked up a record and played it 3 weeks running on his late night spot on Saturday, and the record had any potential at all, can bet your bottom dollar it'd be in the charts. So I went racing off to South Sea, where Jack was appearing on the summer show on the pier there. And I played him this record, and he looked at me and slapped me on the back. And he said, "My boy, you've got a big, big hit here." And he'd already played two records previously of that I had made with Jimmy for that, but they hadn't meant anything. But he liked Jimmy Young. He apparently liked me, and he really thought this record was fantastic. And he said, "Now, can you give me an exclusive on it?" Now, the thing was released on the Saturday, so everybody wanted to play the record during the Saturday, so I gave my word of honour to Jack that if he could give me the works, as he said he would, I would hold it for him for Saturday, which is a very difficult thing to do, because one's life depends on the air promotion pretty well on records. And to say no to a plug was, well, it was, to me, it was second nature going for a plug, and to have to turn them down was heartbreaking. And I think three or four programs that day wanted to use the Jimmy Young in preference to the Nat King Cole, which was in opposition to us. And of course Jack did it. He got in first that night with a fanfare of trumpets and said the greatest British record of the year. It was June 1951. And the thing took off.
They say that love's a word we've only heard, but can't begin to know. This love will last, though years may go, and then someday they may recall.
Jimmy Young with a hit in 1951 covering the Nat Cole version. Practically anyone who was in the business at the time will confirm that as far as British popular material was concerned, the early 50s was a period of famine. The making of cover versions was so widespread in the early 50s, it's possible to assume that practically every British record of the time that you can remember was a cover of an American one.
They've locked up my darling in Allentown jail. Ooh. And no one has come forth to put up his bail. Ooh. They say at the courthouse he'll never go free. Never. Somewhere in Allentown jail,
Allentown Jail, a version by Lita Rosa of that untypical hit of 1951. There was an American version by Joe Stafford, and it's hard to shake off the impression that the standard practice had been followed. But, as Dick Rowe remembers it, he was Lita's A&R man at the time, the British record owed nothing to the American one.
No, it wasn't a cover, actually. It was Ted Heath himself who rang and said, could Lita do this song? And I produced the record with her, and I remember when we made it, I was a bit worried that it wasn't terribly commercial, because it ran a hell of a long time, I don't know, I think nearer 4 minutes than 3 minutes, to start off with. And it was a bit delicate. It had a lot of, horrible thing to think of now, a lot of good taste about it. And then a little while later, or very shortly afterwards, Joe Stafford came out with it, you know, which frightened us a bit, because, you know, she was a very important artist, and we meant instead of having the field to ourselves, we had competition. And then when I heard her record, I really got the wind up, because they cut all kinds of corners. You know, artistry had gone out the window as far as they were concerned. They were making a record to sell. Well, so was I, but Lita and I, everyone concerned, we felt the song very much. We felt it very seriously. And I think as a pop song, it was a serious pop song. And we didn't want to cut corners. And this is a frightening thing, because when you're a record producer, you've got to make money for the company and for the artist and for everyone concerned. And so often, real artistry has to be pushed to one side. But anyway, that was one of the records where we didn't push it to one side. And perhaps the good Lord was on our side at the time, because I think he allowed us to sell as many as Joe Stafford, or he didn't allow her to sell more than us.
Joe Stafford's Allentown Jail was an exception to the rule and came after the Lita Rosa version. But much of Lita's life at the time was spent in covering American releases. And the number she had the greatest success with was more typical of the slightly insane flavour of the period. So typical, in fact, that it might be worth going through the agonies that went into its creation. It was originally recorded by Patti Page and written by Bob Merrill, who had a contract with a publisher requiring him to deliver 4 songs a week. Since inspiration doesn't strike that often, Bob Merrill had to devise an alternative working method.
I practiced something called free association. I'd sit in a room and I'd see a plant, and I'd see a glass, and I would say, glass, plant, plant, glass. Ivy, gin, gin, ivy, for a title, trying to get the wheels to roll. At one point, the most successful application of it was when I had a little toy dog that someone had gifted me with, and I started on looking at the dog, and it said, dog, looking glass, dog, radio, dog, lamp, lamp, dog, window, doggy in window. How much is that doggy in the window?
How much is that doggy in the window? The one with the waggly tail. How much is that doggy in the window? I do hope that doggy is for sale. I must take a trip to California and leave my poor sweetheart alone. If he has a dog, he won't be lonesome, and the doggie will have a good home. How much is that doggie in the window? The one with the waggly tail. How much is that doggie in the window? I do hope that doggie is for sale.
Well, I think Patti Page's How Much Is That Doggy in the Window was an exceptional recording for what it was. I don't think that anyone could have gotten the fantasy across, and rather a silly idea, and made it sound legitimate. As Patti did on How Much Is That Doggy in the Window, it could have been a complete nonsense and hoot. But it came out a rather pretty record, a rather touching record.
It was, I suppose, a worthy successor to Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, and a fit companion for I Thought I Saw Pulitzer. This entire menagerie of song escaped from captivity between 1949 and 53, and seems to be trying to tell us something about the state of popular culture. In spite of the success it brought her, Lita Rosa remembers the episode without enthusiasm.
When they asked me to do Doggy in the Window, I sort of went into the studio, tongue-in-cheek, sang it once and said, that's the only time I'm ever going to sing it and I shall never sing it again. But I've been forced to. The horrible thing about that song is that it was number one in the hit parade for 10 weeks solid. And, see, it was tremendously popular. It's still played. I mean, children still request it. It just stuck with me. You know, I mean, I've worked in sophisticated nightclubs where people have actually asked for it.
I read in the papers there are robbers with flashlights that shine in the dark. My love needs a doggie to protect him and scare them away with one bark. I don't want a bunny or a kitty. I don't want a parrot that talks. I don't want a bowl of little fishes. He can take a goldfish for a walk. How much is that doggy in the window? The one with the waggly tail. How much is that doggy in the window? I do hope that doggy's for sale.
Lita Rosa, a man's best friend, imported from America without so much as 6 months' quarantine. It was not unknown, of course, for an American number to be covered more than once. So, when Radio Luxembourg's Top 20 program began in 1951, it was based on the sales of sheet music and would play different recorded versions of the best-selling numbers as the weeks went by. On the face of it, it looks like another sign of public interest in the competitive aspect of popular music. But in fact, when it was devised by Frank Lee, there was a lot of opposition to it. Listeners said they wanted to hear the stuff they hadn't bought and hadn't heard, not what they had. But Frank Lee prophetically stuck to his idea. And today, pop radio without some sort of chart-based program is quite unthinkable. In spite of what we've been saying about the utter dependence of British record producers on American songs in the early 50s, there was, as ever, some traffic the other way. In 1951, Perry Como had a massive hit in America with a 17-year-old British song by Tolchard Evans, Robert Hargreaves, and Stanley Demereux.
A slave to you. If I had everything, I'd still be a slave to you. If I ruled the night, stars and moons so bright, still I'd turn for love to you. If the world to me bowed, yet humbly I'd plead to you. If my friends were a crowd, I'd turn in my need to you. If I ruled the earth, what would life be worth if I hadn't the right to you?
Perry Como and a British song called If. And there were hits, even in America, which owed their entire existence to Europe. Tune, production, artist and all. Listen to Norrie Paramore and note once more the law of the jungle in operation.
I remember some years back that Eddie Calvert, who had very bad record sales and was due to have his contract dropped by Columbia, and it was my job to make what I thought was his last record. He found one tune called Mystery Street, which I liked, but we still required a B-side. I was discussing this situation with my family at home, And our then au pair girl told me of a tune that she'd heard in her native Austria. I didn't know of it, so she sent home for a copy of the music, which subsequently became the B-side. It was Oh, Mein Papa. But when the disc came out, the critics almost universally slated Oh, Mein Papa and mildly liked Mystery Street. I thought, poor old Eddie, there's another flop for him and the finish of his contract. But just after that, a record man from the USA paid us a visit and wanted to hear our product. So we played him our stock of new recordings, which left him completely cold. This chap, Dave Miller, suddenly came upon Eddie's Mystery Street, but played the B-side by mistake. He immediately went into ecstasies, much to our surprise, and called his office in Philadelphia for a rush release of this. Oh, Mein Papa, of course, became the A-side and achieved more than 1 million sales.
Mein Papa, from German-speaking Switzerland to the American charts via a British trumpet player. Since it was an American record company executive who first spotted the hit possibilities of that, it makes you wonder how many other British records failed because the British record industry didn't know a hit when they heard one. If you haven't been too distracted by doggies in windows, zithers, and powerful operatic tenors, you will have noticed that none of the numbers we've mentioned in this survey of the grocery aspect of popular music has come from a staged musical. Now, that doesn't mean there were no musicals. It merely indicates that taste and social history were on the move once again. The record-buying public was increasing into the millions, while its age was dropping slowly down towards the teens. A new breed of singer was emerging, with no conventional ballad background. People like Johnny Ray and Guy Mitchell, appealing to a different public. The customers for theatre music found themselves to be a smaller proportion of the total market. Popular and pop were starting to be different things. But the stage musical was still a giant force, and old hands like Irving Berlin were still producing superior music.
I was born on 1,000 acres of Oklahoma land. Nothing grew on 1,000 acres, for it was gravel and sand. One day father started digging in a field, hoping to find some soil. He dug and he dug and, what do you think? Oil, oil, oil! The money rolled in and I rolled out with a fortune piled so high. Washington was my destination, and now who am I? I'm the chosen party giver for the White House clientele, and they know that I deliver what it takes to make them gel. And in Washington, I'm known by one and all as the hostess with the mostest on the ball. They would go to Elsa Maxwell when they had an axe to grind. They could always grind their axe well at the party she designed. Now the hatchet grinders all prefer to call. you can make it, if indeed. There are just three things essential. Let me tell you all you need is an ounce of wisdom and a pound of gold. And the hostess, oh, with the mostest on the ball.
Call Me Madam had Ethel Merman in it in New York, which meant that it was practically audible in Britain anyway. The show actually arrived in London in 1952, 2 years after its Broadway opening. There was a similar 2-year interval between the New York and London openings of another big Rodgers and Hammerstein musical, The King and I. Once again, The King and I had a strong book, this time based on the adventures of Anna Leon Owens, the Victorian teacher who went as governess to the King of Siam's children. There was no revolution in style here, but Alan J. Lerner, later to write the lyrics of My Fair Lady, sees it as a sign that the function of the dance element of the musical was changing. It was a question of whether the dancing was a logical part of the action anymore.
I think that what I was beginning to feel about getting rid of ballet, other people were beginning to feel too. I know The King and I, for example, I've just had one set ballet piece, which was done as a piece, the Uncle Tom Ballet. But dancing per se began to lose its significance. Because as the books began to become even more important, if they became the kind of books you couldn't dance. I mean, you couldn't dance the story of The Fair Lady any more than you could dance the story of The King and I. You could dance Skies and Dolls, and you could dance Rigadoon in Oklahoma, you see, but you couldn't dance The King and I.
Victorian governess in 19th century Siam, as seen by 20th century Broadway. Alan J. Lerner, who commented on The King and I, had a new musical on Broadway at the same time. The composer was Frederick Lowe, and the show was Paint Your Wagon. Lerner and Lowe as collaborators are interesting, because while we tend to think of their work as typically American, their biggest successes have been with music intended not to sound American, like My Fair Lady and Gigi. Paint Your Wagon was admittedly American in subject matter, but it dealt with America's gold rush past, a time when the popular music of white Americans was still strongly Scottish and Irish. Yet, when the Scottish and Irish elements had receded still further into the past, the show became more successful as a film. Alan J. Lerner has said somewhere that he attributes that to the fact that its two main male characters are actually up to date in being dropouts.
It was because it was a timeless theme. It was still the past. The gold rush, I think it was the subject matter that probably had a good deal to do with it. They were the original dropouts of the world, so to speak.
I thought this was your home, Paul.
No, I'm moving on, Jen. Some folks ain't meant to settle down. I guess I'm one of them. I was born under a wandering star. I was born under a wandering star. Ain't foot can kill you, sitting still's a curse. But a settle down can drive you mad, moving on is worse. I was born under a wandering star. When I learned to talk, the words he taught me was goodbye. Madam wears my hat is all I need until I die. Aching for the stuff, always aching for the go. Searching but for what I never will know. I was born under a wandering star. A wandering, wandering star.
Bobby Howes with the chorus and orchestra, Wandering Star. Almost unrecognizable in its original form and showing no sign of the number one hit it would eventually become in Lee Marvin's murmured version. Paint Your Wagon arrived on the London stage in 1953. In that year, Call Me Madam closed its London run, but was followed almost immediately.